I think that that's a valid concern. It may be that in an instance where there are numerous assinees or numerous subordinate lien holders, that the seller will want to weigh whether it would be better to do one of the judicial forms of notice such that there can be publication or some other method, that this bill the forfeiture remedy does represent an attempt to provide an easier method for the contract vendor to foreclose the interest. But where the vendee has messed the situation up by selling it to numerous people, it may not be possible for the vendor to do that.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll hit some highlights of the bill. The summary that I've provided in here goes through it and tries to do the same things. Attached also to the letter are some statutes from some other states that you might want to take a look at. You may not, but...
Mr. Carter.
Yes.
Could I ask, Representative Bauman is here and he's taking a break and needs to get back to Ways and Means. Okay. And could we just take a few minute break to hear his testimony on the next bill and we can devote more time, I think. Thank you very much. We'll temporarily close the hearing on House Bill 2361 and open the hearing on House Bill 2531. Representative Bauman, welcome to the House Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, I am Representative Rick Bauman from Portland. I'm here in support of House Bill 2531, which really takes care of, I hope, and addresses an imbalance in the law and really a fairly interesting little glitch in the law. Back in the early 60s, there was a judge from Multnomah County who, either in running for office or after being appointed to office, wanted to live in Washington County and had an exemption drawn into the law where, as you can see, for circuit court judges on line 7, 8, and 9, and then for district court judges on page 2, line 9 and 10, would allow, if you're from Multnomah County, to live with only within 10 miles of the county. All others, district or circuit court judges have to live within their district or circuit, just as one exemption in the state. The effect, when I came across the statute last spring, having been involved in a judicial race, my thought was, let's be equitable for everybody. Let's just don't have residency for judges. And then, but when you actually got into the drafting, there is a provision on line, you see on line 6, which seems to be a reasonable standard, which is you either have to be a resident of the district you're in or your circuit for Multnomah County, that's one and the same, the county is both the district and the circuit. Or you have to have your principal office in the judicial district you're talking about. And that's, I mean, it seems to me a reasonable residency standard for a judge. What you would have now, or there are Multnomah County Circuit and District Court judges living in Clackamas and Washington County, they would be fine because their principal office would be in the county, in the district. If you had a Yamhill County judge who wanted to live in Polk County, that currently would be fine because the principal office would still be in Yamhill County. I'm not sure what your district's like there, your circuit's like. But it seems to me that this is an unwarranted glitch in the law. It probably doesn't make any difference whether it's passed or not, but it looks unfair to me. And I think it should be repealed to have a consistent standard throughout the state.
Thank you. Are there questions from Representative Bellamy?
I would ask the question, or have a principal office in the judicial district. Does that mean that seems to, Rick, I understand how you read it, but that seems to be maybe an archaic form in itself.
Well, that you may want to clarify that either in the record or in statute. When we working with legislative counsel drafting this bill, we had to spend a little time thinking, what is the principal office of a judge? Particularly if you had a large Eastern Oregon circuit and you had 6 or 8 courtrooms that you worked out of. But the principal office, we presume to be wherever you're presiding as judge, and therefore, once you're a judge, you can live any place in the state and still represent your district and circuit or circuit under current law.
Representative Burton?
Yeah, this question came up when we were redesigning some of the districts out
in Eastern Oregon as to where the principal office. And at the time, I was thinking, I was asking myself the question, is this, the principal office is established once you are, in fact, a judge.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to establish the residency requirements to run for judge, you would have to reside in that county. That's the intent, right? And then,
to qualify to be a candidate for judge, you have to meet the eligibility requirements for being a judge, and that's what doesn't speak to candidates here. Under current law, an attorney practicing in Beaverton and living in Beaverton could run for Multnomah County District or Circuit Court judge. That's the exemption, that's the effect of the exemption that we're trying to delete. If that person were practicing with his principal office in Multnomah County under current law, and if you make this change, would still be allowed to run in Multnomah County.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he lived, or she lived in Multnomah County and practiced in Washington County, would be able to run in Multnomah County, or vice versa.
So that if somebody lived in Beaverton but worked for Miller Nash downtown Portland,
right,
could still run for Multnomah County Circuit Judge.
Because their principal office would be in the judicial district under current law. If they lived in Aloha, 10.1 miles out of Multnomah County, and practiced with Miller Nash, they would, under current law, be allowed to run for a Multnomah County judicial position. But if they lived in Aloha and practiced in Beaverton, they wouldn't. If they lived in Beaverton and practiced in Beaverton, they would. It's that glitch we're getting away of. I think it may never apply, but I think the standard should be drawn consistently, which is the residency or principal office, I think, is a fair standard.
And in terms of incumbent judges, since they're for Multnomah County, let's say, since their judge office is their principal office now, when they run for re-election, this is not going to affect any of the current judges.
The only uncertainty there is if you want to ask your counsel the question, what does principal office mean? That's the only place you could get in a problem. It's never been challenged. There's no record there. I'm assuming a principal office for a judge is his courtroom, her courtroom.
Representative Bonner.
Rick, I see a problem with that principal office language. Using the line of reasoning you used, if someone had an auto sales lot, or a lawyer with an auto sales lot with their principal office in Portland, then they would qualify here. It's not, and I'm serious about that, because it's not clear to me, as I read this, principal office would be your principal office as a judge, so that you would have a distinction between incumbents and non-incumbents. Once you became a judge and your principal office were in Multnomah County, you could move anywhere in the state you wanted to under this bill. But
under current law, Representative Biden.
Well, right, but, yeah. But I mean, if you change the language, that would be true outside of Multnomah County, and you'd have a distinction between incumbent judges and candidates, where an incumbent judge, once they located in Yamhill County as a judge, then they could move anywhere in the state, whereas the candidate couldn't do that. So I think it would be beneficial for us to clean up what principal office means.
I think it would be too, and again, that's current law. That's all operating right now. The only thing I'm talking about is whatever we do for the state, let's don't treat Multnomah County separately with this artificial 10-mile limit. Let's define what the residency is, which I think should be some combination of where you practice and or where you live, and apply it statewide.
Rick, is there any justification for saying that the Tri-County area is a little bit different from the rest of the state in the sense that it's all more urban in nature, perhaps, than some of the other counties, and a little bit of distinction?
I don't know this. How do Polk and Marion interact? Are they one district or one circuit?
No, Polk and Yamhill are the 12th Judicial District,
okay.
For example.
For example, then, I mean, I don't think that situation is any different than the Marion County judge who wants to live in West Salem.
We'd have some hesitancy in Yamhill County about Salem people being our judges.
Yeah, I think, I would say, sort of stumble upon this principal office thing. Use your judgment to clarify that, but my argument is get rid of the exemption. It just doesn't make sense.
Thanks.
But there are judges, current judges in Multnomah County that reside in Beaverton or outside
yes.
of Multnomah County.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. We'll try to solve this. Thank you very much. Are there, well,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bellman.
This is kind of interesting because you get to the point where not only when your candidates run is one thing, but then after they're elected, the other factor was, and when it was more rural, was the factor that they wanted judges spread out evenly throughout the state of Oregon for the purposes of search warrants and what have you. That was another reason why you want them to reside in different parts rather than all of the judges in the three or four counties around Marion County living in Salem and driving to their offices. So it's kind of a fascinating thing. It would be interesting to have somebody that's a little more of a history on something like this to review it and actually see if it has much application for today's method and standards of living.
I would agree, sort of like moving a judge from Grand County over to Bennett.
Right.
Well, we'll both get parking. Nobody
yeah.
Parking is the issue.
Is this a parking?
Well, I think council and I will try to come up with some language on.
We might ask a person like Arnold Denneke to look at this and the whole area and see what he would think of it. As, you know, as somebody that been around long enough to gotta be able to tell its history.
Okay. Have we had any contact from the representatives of the Judges Association?
We may want to look.
They're not taking an interest in it. Okay.
Well, so
their watch.
Yeah.
We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2531 and we'll go back to the hearing on 2361. Thank you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you for having a presentation on the parking space.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, before Don gets going again, can we ask him a couple of questions?
Sure.
If that's okay with him?
Certainly.
The whole point of this bill, as you indicate, is the problem of time limits on a forfeiture of a contract. I got to get my mind thinking in this direction here. When I forfeit my contract, which means that I quit paying you, basically what it means, or else that I am doing something that specifically the contract said I shouldn't do. But in most instances, quit paying you. Do you have to wait a certain period of time before you can take action anyway? Is there standards of the court that says that if I'm a day late with a payment that you can't forfeit my contract?
Only in the case of non-self-executing forfeiture clauses. And those are the typical ones where you have one or more remedies in the contract, okay? So like if you have the strict foreclosure, specific performance, and forfeiture, then this court says, yes, you do have to give a certain period of notice, and you have to give the person a right to cure the default, whatever it is.
And you're indicating that in the cases before the court, they have indicated 5, 10, and 12 days?
Well, they've stated that in each case, it depends on the circumstances, it depends on the facts. And so the smallest period of time that I found was 5 days. It appears that 2 weeks would probably be a standard period. There are a number of cases around 10 days or 2 weeks.
Representative Vaughn.
I'm sorry, were you done representing?
Yeah, go ahead.
Where you have multiple remedies for default, the three, and there is a provision in the contract that a minor breach will cause forfeiture, and a time period is given to correct, and correction hasn't occurred. Will the courts generally allow a forfeiture with minor breaches if the contract provides that, or do they find a way around that?
That's a good question. I have not ever looked at the cases to see what kind of a breach has been required before the court would enforce the forfeiture remedy. I think in a number of them, it was merely non-payment for several months. So I would say, I don't know whether that's a minor breach or a major breach.
Well, further question.
Go ahead, Representative Bob.
Is it your thought that with this language cleanup, the forfeiture will be a major effective remedy on an equal footing, so to speak, with those two others?
Well, I still think that there may be reasons why this would not be as useful in some circumstances as the other two remedies. And one of them, of course, is where the purchaser says, I'm staying here, and I don't care what you do, because then you're going to have to file an action and ejectment to get the person out anyway, and that's going to take as much time as it would to file your complaint for strict foreclosure or specific performance.
Well, further question I have in that regard, assuming he leaves and doesn't give you a deed back, don't you have a title insurance problem with the title insurance company saying, we really want some record?
Well, you know, that's interesting. The Supreme Court just decided that, Estate of Brewer versus Iota Delta Chapter, and that's cited
in your letter.
In the letter, it's a December 1984 opinion, and they said that when a contract vendee abandons the contract, that's kind of the flip side of the forfeiture. A mortgagee of the vendee's interest, or an assignee of the vendee's interest, has no further title to the property. And so arguably the title companies are going to look at that and they're going to say, we ought to be able to issue a clean policy. In fact, most of the title companies at the present time will not insure title after a forfeiture unless there's been a suit to quiet title, or they can be persuaded that the purchaser abandoned the contract or something like that. They're very hesitant.
Further question. I just, as conservative as title companies are, even if we clean up this language, I just don't see the title companies coming in and insuring title that way.
One of the title companies had an attorney for one of the title companies who was a member of the real estate and land use section legislative subcommittee that considered this particular bill, and I've spoken about this bill with another large title company's counsel, and they of course are not going to guarantee what they're going to do in any situation, but I think that they certainly feel that the bill provides a better basis to grant title insurance than the current state of the law. In one important respect, I think that's so, and that is the notice requirement is going to be set out in advance, and there doesn't have to be any guesswork about, either from the buyer or the seller's point of view, how much notice is required before I'll lose my interest. I mean, I know I've got 60 days notice or 120 days notice or whatever it is.
Can I ask
Representative
Don, if we specifically, what's the time of notice? How many days notice do you put in the bill?
It depends on how much of the contract has been paid. If you look at section 3, subsection 3, if it's 60 days, if the unpaid balance is greater than 75% of the purchase price, and 90 days if it's between 50 and 75%, and 120 days if it's if the unpaid balance is 50% or less of the purchase price. So up to 4 months.
Now wait a minute here. 60 days.
So if they've only paid 25% of the contract, they get only 60 days. If they've paid 25 to 50%, they get, I'm turning it around, but.
Are we sure that's what it says when you read that language? When the purchaser has reduced the unpaid balance to amount greater than.
Where are you reading?
Page 2, lines
13 through 18.
Right.
That is, if I was a common, ordinary person, I wouldn't understand what that said, and I'm not. I know what you're saying, that if you paid up to 25%, you have 60 days. If you paid up to 50% of the contract, and I assume we're talking about principal and not time.
That's correct.
Okay. Does that specifically say that?
Well, that is the change that I mentioned the Oregon Association of Realtors wants to put in there.
Okay. So, and you're saying that if you paid up to 50% of the contract, you have 90 days, and if you paid up over 50% of the contract, is that what the language says, Dan?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you read that first one, when the purchaser has reduced the unpaid balance to an amount greater than 75%, is that saying that the unpaid balance is an amount greater than 75%?
That's mm-hmm. right.
And can I just ask, the amendment would, what, change it from purchase price to contract price?
No. What the amendment would do is on line 21, and again, I mentioned this in the written testimony, but at the end of the sentence in line 21, a comma would be inserted, and it would say, not including interest.
Oh. Is there any way that you, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, is there any way that you came up with these figures, the 60, 90, and 120 days?
Yes. First of all, the statutes that are attached to the written testimony have varying time periods, and so we looked at those. And then the real estate land use section at its annual meeting looked at those figures and I think just felt that those were fair. Actually, the initial proposal was shorter time periods than this, and in the land use section subcommittee or committee meeting, it was increased. Those are roughly, the longest one, 120 days, is roughly comparable to the notice period required under a deed of trust foreclosure, non-judicial foreclosure of a deed of trust.
Well, Representative Bellman.
Okay.
What happens if, let's say I fall into the first category and I go 61 days. Let's say they've given notice forfeiture. They've said that I'm in default and I have so many days, then I'm noticed. If I go 61 days and I walk up to them, say the 65th day, and say, here's the money that I owe you, would the landowner still have the right to forfeit my contract and take my property?
Under Section 6 of the bill, on page 3, line 6, it says that when the contract has been forfeited, the seller shall record an affidavit and, let's see, perhaps I skipped one too far. It's Section 5.
Section 5. So it says the contract forfeiture remedy may be exercised.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying in Section 5 then is that after 60 days, say I own the contract, and I've said I'm going to forfeit on you, and you come to me and say, no, I'm going to have my money in 5 days or 10 days, once you've initiated the forfeiture, you're not legally bound. You still have to execute something in order to put it into effect. Is that the intent of the bill?
That's correct. The if notice is given, purchaser doesn't cure, then of course the seller has the option, as just exactly as you said, he has the option to say that it's forfeited, or he may not. The seller may decide that it's not forfeited, but there is no redemption period, there's no right of reinstatement thereafter. And then it's just the act of recording that affidavit and everything else to evidence what in fact happened.
Further question to follow up on that.
Representative Bunn.
The recording has no significance other to let people know what happened. Once the time goes by, the forfeiture has occurred unless the seller modifies that.
That is correct.
Representative Bunn.
Yeah, because now we've just said the opposite, right?
Well, the affidavit itself, you don't have to file the affidavit in order to have the forfeiture occur. The forfeiture occurs once the date has gone by. There's no further act. Once that date goes by, if you're a day late, the seller can tell you to fly a kite.
But and in response to that, I'm in agreement with the statement that Representative Bunn made. And what I was trying to say to you, Representative Bellamy, was that the seller, of course, could waive the default at that point and say, I'll forget it. Let's keep going and we'll work something out.
Now, wait a minute, though. Let's say that my little old grandmother or my father has an interest in that. And the two parties say, yeah, they're coming in 10 days with the money, but if you're telling me that once the date is gone, somebody else could come in and say, nope, I'm sorry, you didn't make it on the 60th day, even though you had agreements, you're telling me the intent of this language is once the 60 days is up, no, nothing else has to happen, that the forfeiture is complete.
That's correct.
And if you wanted to protect yourself, you'd have to have a written agreement.
Right.
To do that.
For an extension.
Or it would be a matter of evidence, I suppose. If you could have an oral agreement that and if you could persuade a court that there was an oral agreement, you'd be entitled to a rescission of the forfeiture. I don't know what you'd call it. The forfeiture would be declared invalid, and you'd still have a contract interest.
I just want to make one statement for the committee's sake. I would venture to guess that that maybe as much as the majority of the land that has been conveyed in the last 2 years has been through land sales contracts. And this is a very important thing because we're going to run into problems. The real estate industry has taken a real change in the financing of land. And so this is a very appropriate and very timely issue, but can affect a lot of pieces of property because right now there's a whole lot of forfeiture going on. People have bought property and decided they don't want it anymore.
Representative Bunn.
Well, in terms of practice, if this bill passes, won't buyers' attorneys want to be a little more careful about what things they allow to come under the forfeiture clause?
That's probably true. And perhaps I should qualify that by saying I don't know what the practice is right now with respect to forfeiture. In my experience and in my practice, at the present time, it's either been a question of the forfeiture provision is in there or it isn't in there. In other words, if there's a default under the contract, whatever it is, it can be foreclosed by strict foreclosure or specific performance or forfeiture, regardless of what the default is. So what you're suggesting is that the contracts will say for a monetary default you can use a remedy of forfeiture, but if you paint the house the wrong color you can't do a forfeiture. I think that would probably be new. Now perhaps your experience is different.
No, I think I share your experience on that.
Could I ask, do most contracts, well, I thought perhaps most contracts in terms of a default clause that they would go by after a certain number of monthly payments are missed as opposed to a percentage of payment not made towards the balance owed. Am I wrong?
I would say that most contracts have a time is of the essence provision in them or that a default is declared as soon as there is any default under the contract. You miss one payment and the seller has the right to declare a default and foreclose it by whatever method is permitted under the contract terms.
Well, do they, okay, if it's after one payment, but do they say, but there's a 30-day grace period?
There's nothing in the statute right now that requires any grace period.
No, no, in terms of what the practice is.
And the typical contracts, Stevens Nest forms have forms that have no notice, and others have 10 days or 20 days, both, I've seen. That's a typical legal form. And attorneys...
We bought a house under contract.
Yeah.
I would say
typically, I put in a grace form in ours.
I'd say typically, Mike, if you're buying a residence, there's usually a specified time. If you're just buying a piece of property, there usually is not.
Let me ask you about the effective date of this act then. Can we really do this in Section 7? The way I read this, you're saying that it's going to apply to contracts already written, but there haven't been forfeitures.
If your question is whether it is constitutionally permissible to make this bill apply to
existing
contracts, I think that the answer to that is yes, because this bill affects the remedies that are available, and it would be similar to a change in a procedural format. It does require certain notice that is not presently required, but it is my opinion that this bill would be constitutionally enforceable. First of all, the court system is not